The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up this week, as the Islamist preacher Abu Qatada is released on bail, Britain's politicians unite in their outrage.
The right place for a terrorist is in a prison cell. The right place for a foreign terrorist is a foreign prison cell far away from Britain.
But when he's never actually been charged with anything here, what on earth can be done with Al-Qaeda's so-called main man in Europe? Also this week, as Catholic conservative Rick Santorum gains ground on Mormon Mitt Romney, we ask what role is religion playing in this year's battle for the White House? And what role does it play in British politics as Tory chairwoman Saeeda Wasi takes a shot at militant atheism? Joining me for all of this, we have Nick Cohen from The Observer, who's the author of a new tome on free speech called You Can't Read This Book. Also in the studio, Dr. Giles Fraser, the former Canon Chancellor of St. Paul's, who walked out of the cathedral over its handling of those Occupy protests. And The Guardian columnist Hadley Freeman. A warm welcome to you all. Free to sponge off a country he hates is how the Red Tops this week reported the release of Abu Qatada after 6 years of imprisonment without trial. It's not much of a release, seeing as he'll now be consigned to house arrest for 22 hours a day and his every move's going to be followed by anti-terrorism officers. That, unless the government can somehow convince the European Court at Strasbourg that it can deport him to Jordan to face terror charges there instead. Now, Nick, you don't much like jihadi preachers, but you also do like free speech. The main thing that he's wanted for in Britain is mouthing off in an offensive and inflammatory manner. Where do you stand on the Abu Qatada stuff?
Well, John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, possibly about the most liberal book ever written, said, and I sort of agree with this now, I've come to agree with this, the line on free speech ought to be direct incitement to a crime. And Mill drew that
the
very
right place
tightly.
For a terrorist.
It wasn't,
is in a
the example
cell.
He picked was of a corn
the right
deep,
place for a foreign terrorist is a foreign prison cell
and,
far away from Britain.
And stealing what few pence they had. He said, it's fine for writers and demagogues to damn the corn dealer. They can libel him. You know, he might be, prices might be going up because there's no corn. They can incite hatred against corn dealers. What they can't do is directly incite a mob that's going to burn down the corn dealer's house. With Qatada, I don't know. I mean, he's for the subjugation of women, the murder of homosexuals, the murder of Jews, the murder of any man, Muslim man or woman who of his or her own free will decides to change their religion. His tapes were found in 9/11 bombers' flats. I don't know. In a funny way, with refugees, it's not about free speech. In a funny way, Qatada has free speech, but what's happened is the law has changed. Under the original Geneva Refugee Convention of 1951, I think, if you're a refugee, you've lost your state has abandoned you, and another state can take you on, can make you one of its citizens. But obviously that state always had the right to say, but you hate us, you're a threat to us, we don't have to take you on. So Qatada in some ways was free to speak, and then Britain or any other country was free to say, well, we don't want you because of what you've said. What's happened since is human rights law said that's not good enough. If you send them back and they're going to be tortured or executed, you can't do it, even though under the Geneva Convention you're entitled to refuse them citizenship. And now the European Court, they're now saying with Qatada, even though we know you're not going to be tortured or executed, there's a danger that evidence to be used against you in a criminal trial in Jordan will have been got by torture, so you can't send him back either.
That's right. It's the fact other people would have been tortured and he'll be locked up then in a tainted process. So you would, where do you come down on
Do you want to know what I think should happen?
Yeah.
What should happen. I think he should be put on trial. And we should end this thing in Britain off.
Put in trial here?
Yeah. And we should end this thing, possibly deport him afterwards. But, you know, we have a criminal justice system. He is said to be Osama bin Laden's right-hand man. We should end this ridiculous thing of not using phone tap evidence in court, which is there really for the bureaucratic convenience of the security services and police and customs. Because that lets criminals go away. What I think will happen is that Cameron will find a way to deport him because politically it's all become impossible.
OK, let's just pause there for a moment because earlier in the week we were speaking to Richard Norton Taylor, who has an interesting line in why he's never been tried in Britain, which is what Nick's saying he wants to happen.
Abu Qatada is now regarded as what they call the spiritual ambassador or leader of Al-Qaeda in Europe. And he has not denied spreading, he said, for religious motives. Other people call it more dangerous than that, defending, for example, all sorts of violent acts and global jihad. But originally, MI5 discounted him. They said he was all mouth. And only later did they realise that actually he was, or say, that he was actually a very influential and dangerous person. And the Special Immigration Appeals Commission, which has heard his case many times, which is responsible for deporting or not deporting people, have said that MI5 made a serious error of judgment. Their assessment of Abu Qatada was wrong, i.e. they dismissed him merely as a kind of a person who just shot his mouth off and that was all. And that may be one of the reasons, we don't know, why he hasn't been put on trial in Britain. I would allege Abu Qatada has said things which clearly would allow a prosecution and he'd be tried here under a British law, but he has not been. I've been saying this quite a few times. I've been saying it in the Guardian features for quite a long time. When I say they may be embarrassed, because it is certainly true, it is on the record that MI5, which may be not surprising, did try and persuade Abu Qatada to be an informant for them, and I think he obviously said no thanks, but no thanks. But it is still unclear. Is it embarrassment? I think the security service intelligence sources and people say that no, it's not a question of embarrassment. They don't say why. It can't be just a lack of evidence, I don't think. It's just very, very curious. I think it's a mixture of embarrassment or possibly this other thing. And that's what a lot of people in Whitehall says. It says that they didn't really think about bringing up a case against him in a British court because they thought, and this is wishful thinking, that he could be deported.
Richard Norton Taylor with a rather unconventional take on it there, saying that the security services might be embarrassed and that's the only thing stopping a trial in Britain. But Giles, I mean, where do you come down on it? Should we be kicking this guy out? He's not going to be tortured himself. Nobody wants him here. It's just a question of whether he gets a fair trial in Jordan.
Well, I agree with Nick. We should put him on trial here. I mean, I think that innocent until proven guilty is important for when it's difficult as when it's easy. I mean, it's actually under test when it's at its most difficult. And we can't... There is no crime. It's not Minority Report with Tom Cruise. You know that what fantastic film where you get into trouble for things you're going to do in the future. I mean, there's no law that works like that. So we have to try this person for what he may or may not have done, and we have to do it in this country. And just, we can't have our own rather domestic version of Guantanamo Bay where we don't know what to do with him, so we shove him under house arrest here. We know that it's wrong in Guantanamo Bay, and we shouldn't do our own very British version of that over here either.
Hadley, America's got famously a kind of strong tradition of pride in its free speech. What do you think would happen? Well, what does happen with kind of radical jihadis who stand up and say terrible things over there?
Well, I think Guantanamo Bay is quite the obvious example there that Giles has just brought up. I can't imagine that Abu Qatada would be treated any better in America. Certainly there's far more sort of heightened Arab phobia, I guess, is what, or Islamophobia in America than here. Definitely. I mean, even despite the free speech, there's still a lot of fear of that.
America does have a wonderful thing in the First Amendment that just says, as a bedrock of society, and sparing Giles's presence, you know, there will be a separation of church and state. There will be... the state cannot intervene with religious with your religion, freedom of speech, or freedom of the press. And America does many, many terrible things, but that's always there for you, and we don't have something like that here.
That's true. It kind of also is about to take us into our next topic, I believe, in that there's an increasing sort of melding in the election of church and state. But maybe I should let you take us into that one,
well,
Tom.
Actually, Hadley, one point, because you're here. Mm. Here's what worries me about the European Court decision. The way it's in regress, the way it used to be, well, a state could refuse someone who's an enemy. Now, no, you can't send them back if they'll be tortured or executed. No, when there might be evidence against them from torture. Look at what Obama's done. With all the stuff about Guantanamo and the endless petitions and ACLU and all of that, and Obama seems such a nice guy, I said, actually, I'm going to stop bothering arresting these people. I'm just going to kill them in drone strikes. There is a point when governments just snap and say, the hell with all this. And what worries me is governments going to start pulling out the Refugee Convention, which, you know, is a rather good thing.
Charles, you're nodding there. I mean, nodding because you think Obama's a nice guy for just deciding to shoot people instead.
No, I wasn't nodding with that. I was nodding in agreement. I was nodding in agreement. One of the worst things that happens is when people feel, when governments feel trapped, they don't know what to do, then they'll often, as Nick said, go for an even worse option, which is take them out. I mean, that's happening all over the place.
I mean, if Bush had done that, can you imagine how the world would have gone potty? But because it's Barman, he's progressive and he's the first black president, he's cool. No one really talks about it.
Well, he's not as progressive as people think.
Right.
And Hadley, I suppose the other thing that's interesting about this is there's clearly a European kind of context here. There's a lot of bashing of the Conservatives on the, sorry, of the Europe on the Conservative benches at the moment. It's Strasbourg in this case rather than Brussels, but even so, it all gets mixed up in the same thing. When you hear that we've got this court, it can rule on us, and then lots of politicians are saying, let's just defy it. Does it bring to your mind, what would you think if, I don't know, an American president was saying, let's just defy the Supreme Court? Does it feel like that kind of thing?
Well, a little bit, but it feels more, it's a wrong comparison. So coming back to London and from having spent a lot of time in America, and it feels sort of more like children arguing against their parents in a certain sense, the way when get conservatives arguing against the European court. It also feels a little bit like when very right-wing politicians in America take these very sort of hardline stands against gay rights and all the rest, and are very sort of almost inciting Islamophobia. And what they're actually behaving like is the countries that they're so fearful against. And in a way, when you hear conservatives arguing that we should just send someone back to a country where he would be tried using evidence under torture and behaving in a way that's not Great Britain, it's like you do realize that you're behaving slightly, you're almost encouraging an attitude that's sort of more akin to a country that you're fearing in a sense. Great Britain is a great country with a criminal justice system. We should be using that, as Nick says.
It's not just Tories doing this. I mean, Labour are as hardline. There are problems with European Court of Human Rights. I mean, it's one problem is it's not ours. I mean, Americans, I love America for this, that Americans who even hate what you're saying, except we have free speech in this country. Mm-hmm. It's part of our constitution. The European Court has got a lot of trouble. They let Russia in, which is just a disaster. So it's flooded with cases from Russia and Turkey. And there are far too many cases. The judges are of very poor quality from a lot of countries. So you get quite left-wing lawyers now saying we should stick for the European Convention on Human Rights, but make the Supreme Court in London the ultimate judge, not Strasbourg.
But, I mean, it's obviously, Nick, part of a much wider picture, and it, more particularly on the right, isn't it, about what happens with the European Union and whether we can... Yeah. It all gets mixed up like that, doesn't it?
No, I was talking... I'm sure I'm not betraying a confidence here. I was talking to George Walden, who's a very educated former Conservative MP, and he voted against Maastricht in the early 90s because he could see, as most intelligent people could see, the euro was just wrong. It was always going to be trouble. But he said of his fellow Tories, he said to me, well, they weren't voting against it because they understood, you know, the complexities of economics. They're voting against it because they thought the French were silly and the Germans were sinister. You know, and it was just prejudice, you know.
OK, let's leave Europe and Qatada there for a moment. You can follow the Qatada case as it unfolds at guardian.co.uk/politics. But now let's zoom across the Atlantic, because it's a few weeks since we've considered the rather up and down race for the Republican nomination. Back then, Newt Gingrich suddenly looked like the man to beat. Since, however, it's been Mitt Romney who scored a thundering win in Florida, and then suddenly this happened.
Big news overnight in the race for president. Your voice, your vote. Rick Santorum beats Mitt Romney in not one, not two, but three contests. Colorado, Missouri, and Minnesota in a race full of twists and turns. Another stunner.
Mitt Romney is now living the famous line from Godfather 3. Just when I think I'm out, they pull me back in. This new Santorum surge, a big statement from Republican voters telling Romney, you were not the Republican nominee yet. This is not over.
Wow. So, Hadley, it could be Santorum who's the nominee. Should we be very afraid?
Well, no. In a way, Democrats are very much hoping that it's Santorum because he will be much easier in a way for Obama to beat. There will be no independents who would vote for Santorum in the way that there might be for Mitt Romney. Whether he actually can make it with his views, which are decidedly fringe.
Go on, fill us in.
Well, he believes that contraception is bad for society and for women. He believes that homosexuality is the same as bestiality and pedophilia. He believes that we should nuke Iran. I mean, his views are very, very far to the right. He is Roman Catholic. His views are sort of as hardline Roman Catholic, but in a way that doesn't embrace a lot of Christianity, the mainstream Christianity in America.
Vatican II passed him by, does it?
Yeah, exactly.
The devil's work.
Exactly. But he well could be, because Mitt Romney, I mean, it it's at the moment, it's between a Catholic and a Mormon. You know, Mitt Romney is Mormon. And the evangelical vote is incredibly important to the Republicans in terms of the primaries and in the general election. And evangelicals do not like Mormons as a rule. They do not see Mormon, they do not see the Mormon religion. And a lot of Christians agree with this, but particularly evangelicals. They do not see Mormonism as Christianity. They have a completely different concept of God. Their God is a much more human figure. He is not the Father and Son, the Holy Ghost combined. Also, evangelicals don't like Mormons because they are incredibly good at fundraising, has been another problem. They've become incredibly prominent and more powerful. Romney is very closely allied with the Mormon Church. He's tithed over $4 million of his personal fortune over the years to it. And he's very good friends with the sort of head honchos in the Mormon Church in Salt Lake City. So there's a lot of suspicion of how much he would push a Mormon agenda were he to be in the White House. I mean, that's just one of the problems for Romney. I mean, there's so many other problems for Romney being elected, in the fact that his views have changed so much on abortion and gay rights. He is so incredibly wealthy. He's seen as a kind of very typical figure of that financial industry, which people are now very suspicious against. I mean, the Republican voter base is far more diverse in a way than the Democrats. The Republicans are both the sort of very wealthy elite that we think of in terms of the Reagan era, as well as the sort of more blue-collar workers in the South and the very devout Christians. And to have someone whose job was, according to all the sort of anti-Romney adverts that are shown now in the different states, someone whose job was to go into different states, buy up companies, and then fire everybody from them, that's a very unappealing message to a lot of Republicans.
I mean, it's striking, isn't it, from a European, so I was going to say British perspective, but really European perspective, that amid this slump, and Hadley said this stuff's coming back to haunt Romney now on the vulture capitalism, but that they're talking about, you know, condoms and things
it is very interesting, because the Tea Party, I mean, entirely misguidedly in my view, the Tea Party's main argument was an economic argument. It was about slashing deficits. It was about saying, oh my God, big government is taking over Wall Street, when, you know, big government damn well should have taken over Wall Street to regulate the debt. But you know what I mean? And people who looked at the Tea Party said, you know, the old Christian conservative views are barely registering here. They're not interested in gay marriage or abortion or contraception.
And
suddenly the damn thing's risen from the grave. And you suddenly see in Santorum a classic, okay, he's Catholic, but, you know, evangelical candidate.
And sex, issues of sex are very central to Santorum. He's given lots of interviews talking at length about the sanctity of marriage. It should be between man and a woman, and you shouldn't use contraception because sex is sacred, and that if his daughter was raped, he would not allow her to have an abortion because every pregnancy is a gift from God. And he says...
You can see Obama just going, please,
I know,
please,
or David Axelrod must be just jumping up and down. But he says, I know a lot of politicians don't say this kind of thing, but it is important, because I think a lot of the public say, why are we focusing on this? Our interest is in jobs. Our interest is in the economy. And the fact is, that is what Santorum focuses on. That's a major tenet of his beliefs.
So, Giles, what do you make of the fact that it sounds like the different factions of American religion are more wound up with each other in terms of the problems that Mormon Romney's having with the evangelicals and so on than they are in uniting? Is it surprising?
Well, that's always been the case. You know, the People's Front of Judea have always hated the Judean People's Front in the life of Brian. I mean, there's this. You go through America, it's absolutely extraordinary when you go church after church after church, and they sort of split with each other and they fall out with each other. I mean, I think what's really interesting is actually that this sort of like feared evangelical right is actually, I think, beginning to decline in influence. I actually think it's no longer as powerful as it used to be. What you have is no classic evangelical, Protestant evangelical candidate, credible one. There is not one here. That's why this whole thing is complicated. You have Romney, who doesn't fit. You have Santorum, who doesn't fit. There is not...
And Gingrich is a Catholic convert.
There is not a candidate here who fits that mould. And actually, demographically, and especially with young people, that whole thing that was sort of, you know, brought Ronald Reagan and was at its height in the sort of, you know, the latter part of the 20th century is now beginning to turn people off. So, yes, a lot of these people, I mean, Santorum has really crazy views, and it's very easy to associate him with the crazy views that conservative evangelicals have, but he is emphatically not a conservative evangelical. He isn't that sort of Protestant tub-thumping tele-evangelist style in terms of where he comes from. Actually, what's happening here is that the Conservative evangelicals are losing their grip. They have not got a candidate. They will sit on their hands for both of these. I mean, they'll probably vote for Santorum at a pinch. They probably wouldn't like Romney for the reasons Hadley said, because he's a Mormon. But actually, Obama is fantastic. It's brilliant for Obama, because what will happen, whoever of these two gets there, that there won't be an enthusiasm from the sort of Conservative evangelicals for either of these candidates. I think Obama will just win.
I just want to ask Hadley something, because, you know, never call another country's election. I mean, it's bad enough trying to call your own country's election. But it seemed to me at the end of last year, if the Republicans could only find a decent candidate, they could have given Obama, who, you know, has presided over massive wiping out of personal wealth, you know, unemployment, housing collapses, they could have given him a decent run.
Well, the thinking really is that the candidates who could have given him a decent run, such as Jeb Bush or Rubio or Chris Christie, are sitting this one out because they don't want to run against an incumbent, that they're waiting for 2016. And I think then it'd be interesting to see if that evangelical base coalesces again and comes back, because if we get another Bush, as extraordinary as that idea might be, then they will come back. Yeah, Rubio as well, he would be quite a good one to get behind. Christie, not so much. I think this one is just Romney is basically the Republicans' John Kerry, in that this kind of very weak, very wealthy candidate who doesn't inspire anybody. And this is what often happens when someone runs against an incumbent. I mean, God knows we've had only one-term presidents before. There was the first George Bush who was one-term president, Jimmy Carter. But in this one, I think the Republicans, the mainstream Republicans, are sitting it out, letting this go.
See, I find it a bit extraordinary that. I mean, it's the same. You talk to people in the Labour Party who think Ed Miliband is a disaster. And I said, well, why don't you get rid of him? Why don't you put someone else in? Oh, well, we're writing off the next election.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
If you're sincere about what you think your country is going terribly wrong, if you're a sincere politician, you try and do something about it. You don't say, well, actually, you know, my PR people, my planners say it's got to be 2016, not now.
Well, the concept of a sincere politician now is something of an oxymoron. I think all of them are seeing it in terms of their careers, and they just see this would be a wasted election to run against. That
Obama was beatable.
He was beatable, but you'd have to really run hard. I mean, the Democrats are still... There's still a lot of Democrats who love him.
Yes, I think Obama was is beatable. I mean, with the economy and all the issues with the economy.
But it's picking up.
Picking up now, but I still think that there's, you know, and if you'd have got a sort of, I mean, I wouldn't have voted for them. A lot of people wouldn't. But if you'd had a sort of conservative evangelical who was sort of liberal on the economy, you could have given him a big run for his money, it seems to me.
I kind of suspect, and this is just my own theory, that the candidates who could have run against him decided against it when he killed Osama bin Laden, and they just thought this was a great Trump card, and they would just wait until 2016.
Is it also, Hadley, they're waiting for the Tea Party sort of...
To get back together?
No, they're waiting for die
oh,
out.
Oh, to go out.
Because you can see with Romney, even if he wins... He will have had to have changed his views so often to just sneak the nomination. To ordinary voters, he just looks like a complete hypocrite who just flip-flops on everything.
Yeah, you know. And to the Tea Party. I mean, the problem with the Tea Party is they sort of created this situation, and the sort of the Santorum-esque evangelical voters, that in order to be electable within the Republican Party, you have to be completely inelectable to everybody else. So in order for that influence to fall away is crucial for someone like Bush or Rubio.
And Sarah Palin, we haven't mentioned Sarah Palin because I don't know why she was had to come up with this conversation, but that's a classic example of someone who's electable to the Republican Party but unelectable to everybody else.
Yeah, not so much anymore. I mean, she was at the CPAC thing when she got an enormous cheer, but I don't think that Karl Rove would even let her get anywhere near a nomination. She is too ridiculous on the main stage. She's too uninformed, and there are too many scandals about her now, too much bad stuff about her. Even she knew that, and she's Sarah Palin.
However, chaotically they may do so, there's no doubt that American politicians do God. Whereas this week, traditionally in Britain, we haven't done so in Alistair Campbell's famous phrase. But this week, Baroness Wasey, who's the chair of the Tories, Giles, has been out to see the Pope and has been giving a speech trying to bring God over here too, in her way.
It's a very odd thing, the difference between us and Americans on the God thing, because, as Nick said, you know, in America they have this separation of church and state built into their constitution, and yet, of course, they're incredibly religious. And on the flip side, we have a sort of, as it were, a religious state. I mean, in no separation of church and state, and yet we're not very religious. And I'm very interested in the way that those two may relate to each other, the way in which the establishment, there's a religious establishment of this country, is a way, perhaps, of sort of domesticating religion. and the way in which the sort of way in America you allow religion its sort of its head, and actually it becomes much more powerful and influential. If you look at those places, if you look, for instance, at states that have church tax. So, like in Sweden and Germany and places like that, where, you know, you pay a small tax, nobody goes to church. Completely and utterly uninfluential. But if you go to a place where there's a sort of free market in religious expression, no relationship to the state, separation of church and state, then in a place like America, it seems to be incredibly powerful.
Well,
so when people talk about
state.
Yes, of course,
that
France is the great counterexample to what I'm saying. But nonetheless, I think that I don't necessarily think that if you, I mean, I'm in favour of the disestablishment of the church, but I think if you separate them, it doesn't actually mean, as America experience abundantly shows, that you stop the influence of religion on politics.
I mean, but what do you make of the Wazi speech? I mean, so we are where we are in Britain with an established church that, you know, people don't pay the attention to, they might do. But is she right, do you think, to say that the, you know, there's a militant secularism abroad that's crowding out the role of religion rather aggressively?
One of the things she said that I did agree with is that if religious people are more confident in their in what they believe, then they're not going to be threatened by other people. And that's the point where, actually, I think with, you know, all this talk about militant secularism, I actually think it's religious people sounding terribly threatened. I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with, you know, those are good debates, important debates to have. And the fact that we live in a society where a lot of people want there to be a separation of church and state, absolutely fine. I don't see why my faith, for instance, ought to be threatened by that. And I think religious people sound desperately defensive where they start talking about militant secularism and taking over and Britain is a Christian country and that's all under threat. I actually think that's just that terribly defensive. I mean, I don't want my faith to be defended by Eric Pickles. I mean, he's not the person that I want up there on the front saying, you know, that's how my faith gets to be defended. I think that the confidence should be not hiding behind the state, but what it is we believe in.
Nick, I don't know if you heard Giles this week having a go at Richard Dawkins.
Oh, he
on
really
the radio.
Tripped him up, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, do you think this is all fair cop, that irreligious people can be as rude as they like to the religious people, and then vice versa as well?
Well, I mean, let's be honest about Britain. You can't to Islam. Ever since Salman Rushdie, there's massive self-censorship going on. You can to Christianity because, however much atheists and secularists like me might mock Christianity for its faults, we know that Christians aren't going to kill us. So let's be frank about self-censorship in this country. But I do find this militant atheism a little odd. There was militant atheism in the 20th century. There still is in China and North Korea. I mean, the communists persecuted Christians, burned churches. You could talk about militant atheism then. But now, I mean, if you're going home on the tube and it blows up, it won't be militant atheists who've done it. If you're a Catholic in West Belfast and your home's attacked, it's not people who've read Richard Dawkins, or indeed my new book, which I don't think you've plugged enough, Tom, saying they've read Nick Cohen on opposition to religious censorship and we're going to burn out Catholics.
I'll go into another carriage if I see someone reading that.
You know, if you're in Pakistan, it's not militant atheists who are bombing Shia mosques or getting Christian women condemned to death for apostasy. You know, it's mistaking the arguments of democracy for some kind of extremism or tyranny.
I mean, there's a possibility of a real row between us on this point, because I get terribly twitchy about the way in which this sort of talk of Islam, I mean, the relationship between sort of new atheism and this sort of talk about Islam. And I think that new atheism is a post 9/11 phenomena, that they won't talk more clearly about what it is, which is actually really Islam. Islam is the sort of unacknowledged other that in this debate. And
well, okay.
I think it's, I begin to get really twitchy about it at this point.
Well, first of all, new atheists aren't so different from old atheists. We still don't believe in God, for instance, to mention the prominent continuity. Second, you know, in Europe, from Salman Rushdie onwards, writers are murdered. The problem with your attitude is not just ex-Muslim writers who are murdered and threatened. It's liberal Muslims who have often come to Europe to escape, in case of refugees from Iran, to escape the mosque militants. And when they confront theocracy here, they turn round to people like you, who are liberal, who are Democrat, who I presume are feminist as well, and find them saying, well, actually, no, we can't really help you. I mean, there's every reason to be wary of Islamophobia. I'm not one of these people who say it doesn't exist, that there aren't people who just hate Muslims because they're Muslims. The problem with it is where it comes out. The position of liberal immigrants and the children of liberal immigrants in Europe at the moment is, on the one side, they have the theocrats in their own community who threaten them. On the other side, they have white racists. And then the liberals who ought to be the white liberals who ought to be their natural supporters just aren't there for them. They're making excuses for the religious right. They're indulging it. And to use very old-fashioned left-wing language, what's happening is a big betrayal of camaraderie, of values of, you know, I'm a feminist, you're a feminist, we stick together. I'm a liberal, you're a liberal, we stick together. And so this nervousness is, you know, stops liberals being liberals.
I mean, Hadley, you were saying a moment ago that people being particularly wound up about Islam rather than religion in general is a much more common phenomenon in the US. So maybe...
I don't know if it's more common there than here, but there's certainly still fear of it. I mean, you know, it was the site of 9/11. And maybe this is completely wrong to say, but certainly when I moved to London as a child, in my class at school, there were lots of Arab children, which is something I hadn't experienced in America. So you mix more in London than I did in New York. So it is still, it is more, because it feels more like an other.
Also, to take it away from Islam, if we were sitting in a liberal newspaper in India, I don't know, the Times of India maybe, our main worry would be Hindu nationalism, which persecutes artists, writers, academics, anyone who challenges the tenets of Hindu nationalism. All religions have, and all ideologies, when they get extreme, have the capacity to persecute and to censor. But the thing to do is to stand by those people who are the victims of it. And overwhelmingly in Europe, the first aim of any ideology is to oppress its own people. And overwhelmingly in Europe, the victims of Islamic extremism are Muslims, are liberal Muslims.
I mean, I respect that position. I'm sure there's differences between us on it. I respect that position. My anxiety is really the way in which certain sorts of debates over religion become cover for debates over something else. You're sort of like very clear. What you see is what you get about the position, and that's easy to debate with. So I hate it when, you know, the sort of British National Party, or whatever, say they really want a Christian country. Yeah. Well, what they really mean is they want a white country. And, you know, so they'll use that as sort of apparently non-racist language, the defence of Christian Britain.
The English Defence League are more worrying.
Also, the flip side of that, there is also a way in which the sort of attack of religion is another sort of code and cover for an attack on Islam quite specifically, but you feel you're not allowed to say that in the way that you say it quite openly and you're able to be questioned about it. And I find that, you know, so when Richard Dawkins says Islam is the most evil religion in the world or something like that, I just think, actually, how much of this sort of stuff is really not open to the sort of scrutiny that your position is
What do you think when Dawkins says that?
I'm not sure he did say it. It sounds like an odd thing to say.
He did. In terms of
theocracy, the theocracies in the world at the moment are places like Saudi Arabia and Iran. And assume you're not a Tory, if a Conservative were to say, look, we're a free society, obviously. You're free to say what you want, but you cannot attack free market theory because that's being offensive. That's going too far. You would hand a great advantage to conservative parties. If you accept what began with Khomeini and say, actually, it's too dangerous for you either to criticise the basis of my theocratic rule or to, if you're a Muslim, to convert away from it, you're apostate like Rushdie, you're dead, you then hand theocrats huge power. I think we're too nervous, far from there being militant atheism, I think we are too nervous about offering support, vigorous support, to particularly the Iranian left and Iranian liberals who don't want people who bite their tongues. And as for Richard and the so-called new atheists, I mean, what really got them going, what really, you know, got them out of bed in the morning was George W. Bush and Christian conservatives in America. They loved all of that. Because in the end, it wasn't that frightening.
It would have got me out of bed in the morning, yeah, too. So,
but I mean, what do you make, Giles, just of this idea that Islam, you know, if there is a bomb that goes off, it probably will be Islam.
Islamists. I mean, it's a very important distinction. I mean, look, there are neo-Nazi terrorists in Britain, not that successful, thankfully. But if you just said they are British, terrorists and didn't make a distinction of neo-Nazis, then you say, well, what do you mean they're British? You're trying to tar whole Britain. There's Islam, which is a religion practiced by hundreds of millions of people. There's Islamism, you know, developed in the 1940s, a political program of the extreme religious right.
And but I mean, is it that different from George W. Bush's attempts to run a kind of Christian government?
Well, I mean, when Nick spoke earlier about importance of sort of solidarity, I guess, with people, I think that, you know, we ought to express our solidarity for the millions of ordinary people who are Muslim, who are trying to sort of get on in the world, and often in really difficult circumstances with bloody awful governments and so forth. That's I do agree with you on that, but I don't see the way through to do that by actually casting Islam itself as this great
well,
evil.
I think there's Islamism. It's an important distinction.
I agree. That's exactly
that's
right.
But that's a political movement that mainly oppresses Muslims.
Exactly right. But we were talking about theology before, and so the idea that it slips from Islamism, which is a political version, Islam in and of itself. Yes, but Islam in and of itself. Wait, for me, you're just talking about the faith of ordinary people for the most part, and I find that using Islam as a sort of way to attack people is actually not expressing precisely the sort of solidarity that you were calling upon people to have.
I hope I can criticise the faith of ordinary Jews, and I do. I criticise the faith of ordinary Christians, and I do, or ordinary Hindus. I'm on the board of the National Secular Society. Throw me any religion. I can do it. I think what's going to change in this country is when you're already getting a generation of what would have once been regarded as classically left-wing and liberal Muslims coming through. Although you're seeing this across Europe, they're all turning to the Tory party because they think the left has rejected them. I think the left is, you know, the Ken Livingstone left has gone along with al-Qaradawi and Iran and all the rest of it, and is no longer, again, to use 20th century language, virtually dead, is no longer their comrade.
Well, at some point we'll have to interrogate whether or not Muslims are voting any number for the Tories.
No, I was talking about young, feminist, liberal Muslims who are fighting against theocracy. That they don't regard the left as their friends anymore.
But for the moment, that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Hadley Freeman, to Giles Fraser, and to Nick Cohen, whose brilliant new book, You Can't Read This Book, is out now. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.